This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
One of the things I really notice the most about when I'm coming to any of the Sangha events, any of the Against the Stream events, is that I feel really comfortable and I feel at ease. Because there's something about being with other Dharma practitioners or mindfulness practitioners or people that care that tells me that we're going to listen to each other, that we're going to be heard, that we're going to be seen in a way that's maybe really different from how it typically is out in the world. And that's part of what I want to talk about tonight. I want to talk about listening, about communication, about how we hear each other, and why that's important. But first I want to tell a story about that. It's kind of a long story. But I'm a mom, and I like to read books to my kids at night, so I'm going to do that tonight. There was a time in my life 20 years ago when I was driving a cab for a living. This isn't about me, by the way. It was a cowboy's life, a gambler's life, a life for someone who wanted no boss, constant movement, and the thrill of a dice roll every time a new passenger got into the cab. What I didn't count on when I took the job was that it was also a ministry. Because I drove the night shift, my cab became a rolling confessional. Passengers would climb in, sit behind me in total anonymity, and tell me of their lives. We were like strangers on a train, the passengers and I, hurtling through the night, revealing intimacies we would never have dreamed of sharing during the brighter light of day. I encountered people whose lives amazed me, ennobled me, made me laugh, and made me weep. And none of those lives touched me more than that of a woman I picked up late on a warm August night. We know what that's about, right? As I was responding to a call from a small brick fourplex in a quiet part of town, I assumed I was being sent to pick up some partiers or someone who had just had a fight with a lover or someone going off to an early shift at some factory from the industrial part of town. When I arrived at the address, the building was dark, except for a single light in a ground floor window. Under these circumstances, many drivers would just honk once or twice, wait a short minute, then drive away. Too many bad possibilities awaited a driver who went up to a darkened building at 2:30 in the morning. But I had seen too many people trapped in a life of poverty who depended on the cab as their only means of transportation. Unless the situation had a real whiff of danger, I always went to the door to find the passenger. It might, I reasoned, be someone who needs my assistance, who I would not want a driver to do the same if my mother or father had called for a cab. So I walked to the door and knocked. "Just a minute," answered a frail and elderly voice. I could hear the sound of something being dragged across the floor. After a long pause, the door opened. A small woman, somewhere in her 80s, stood before me. She was wearing a print dress and a pillbox hat with a veil pinned on it, like you might see in a costume shop or a Goodwill store or in a 1940s movie. But by her side was a small nylon suitcase. The sound had been her dragging it across the floor. The apartment looked as if no one had lived in it for years. All the furniture was covered with sheets. There were no clocks on the walls, no knickknacks or utensils on the counters. In the corner was a cardboard box filled with photos and glassware. "Would you carry my bag out of the car?" she said. "I'd like a few moments alone. Then, if you could come back and help me, I'm not very strong." I took the suitcase to the cab, then returned to assist the woman. She took my arm, and we walked slowly toward the curb. She kept thanking me for my kindness. "It's nothing," I told her. "I just tried to treat my passengers the way I would want my mother treated." "Oh, you're such a good boy," she said. Her praise and appreciation were almost embarrassing. When we got in the cab, she gave me an address, then asked, "Could you drive through downtown?" "It's not the shortest way," I answered. "Oh, I don't mind," she said. "I'm in no hurry. I'm on my way to a hospice." I looked in the rearview mirror. Her eyes were glistening. "I don't have any family left," she continued. "The doctor says I should go there. He says I don't have very long." I quietly reached over and shut off the meter. "What route would you like me to go?" I asked. The next 2 hours, we drove through the city. She showed me the building where she had once worked as an elevator operator. We drove through the neighborhood where she had and her husband had lived when they were first married. She had me pull up in front of a furniture warehouse that had once been a ballroom where she had gone dancing as a girl. Sometimes she would have me slow in front of a particular building or corner and would sit staring into the darkness, saying nothing. As the first hint of sun was creasing through the horizon, she suddenly said, "I'm tired. Let's go now." We drove in silence to the address she had given me. It was a low building, like a small convalescent home, with a driveway that passed under a portico. Two orderlies came out to the cab as soon as we pulled up. Without waiting for me, they opened the door and began assisting the woman. They were solicitous and intent, watching her every move. They must have been expecting her. Perhaps she had phoned them right before we left. I opened the trunk and took the small suitcase up to the door. The woman was already seated in a wheelchair. "How much do I owe you?" she asked, reaching into her purse. "Nothing," I said. "You have to make a living," she answered. "There are other passengers," I responded. Almost without thinking, I bent and gave her a hug. She held on to me tightly. "You gave an old woman a little moment of joy," she said. "Thank you." There was nothing more to say. I squeezed her hand once, then walked out into the dim morning light. Behind me, I could hear the door shut. It was the sound of the closing of a light. I did not pick up any more passengers that shift. I drove aimlessly, lost in thought, for the remainder of that day. I could hardly talk. What if that woman had gotten an angry driver, or one who was impatient to end his shift? What if I had refused to take the run, or had honked once, then driven away? What if I had been in a foul mood and had refused to engage the woman in conversation? How many other moments like that had I missed or failed to grasp? We are so conditioned to think that our lives revolve around great moments, but great moments often catch us unawares. When that woman hugged me and said that I had brought her a moment of joy, it was possible to believe that I had been placed on earth for the sole purpose of providing her with that last ride. I do not think that I have ever done anything in my life that was any more important. I've read that story so many times and it just kills me. Because what else is there? I almost feel like I could say, okay, let's go home. You know? Seriously. What else is there? And so often we are in such a rush, or we're looking for such an intense moment, or some sort of me-ing happening, that we just forget. We forget what's really needed, which is just to slow down and to show up. So we don't know who's going to walk through our life or who's going to need us in any given moment. So I'm really caught in this place right now, just personally, of where I want to go right now with this talk with you guys. Because stillness is so needed, you know, and silence is so needed. And I know that oftentimes we come here for and to hear something, maybe that will deeply connect to. It'll be important, that'll maybe change our lives. And other times we really just need to be and sit and be quiet and recognize what's going on inside for us. And then in turn, so we can really see another. And I know for me, a big, probably the biggest reason why I've come to this practice is because I felt so disconnected, so alone, so separate from others. And I didn't understand why. As a kid, as a teenager, very, very rebellious teenager, I didn't understand why. And so much of it was just because I wouldn't stop and see them. I wanted them to see me, but I wouldn't stop to see them. The nomadic tribes have this really beautiful belief that they have an elder, you know, their sort of tribal leader, and he carries a staff. And wherever they're going, wherever they land, they put the staff in the ground. And to them, that is the center of the universe. Wherever that staff lands is the center of the universe. And they have these practices because they don't have televisions and they don't have phones and they don't have all these other ways of communicating globally. They're there with each other, actually. They have these practices where that staff that they carry around, they sit in circle, called council. We call it council here, but they sit in circle and they pass that staff around. And whoever's holding that staff is now the center of the universe to them. So anything that comes out of the mouths of those people that are holding the staff is the truth. It's everything. There's nothing else. Because that staff is the center of the universe. And I think that's such a beautiful, beautiful practice. And what if, you know, what if we did that? What if we held that as our practice? And there are, you know, there are so many things that stop us from being able to deeply listen to people. And some of them are super valid. So I want to talk about some of those, and I actually want to ask you guys what some of those are. What would stop you from listening to somebody deeply? So I'm going to throw out a few, and then you can tell me a few. But first I want to tell you another little story that I told the other day at our women's group. A teacher of mine, she works often on a reservation, on an Indian reservation in the San Diego area. And there was a woman that came back who had been gone for about 10 years that grew up on this reservation, and she'd been there and grew up there, and everybody knew her and loved her, and then she went away. And she noticed that when she came back, people weren't being very kind to her, that she was kind of ostracized, and she felt really left out and unheard, and people were kind of scowling at her all the time and treated her really shitty. And she wasn't sure why. And this friend, who was my teacher, was a teacher on this reservation, a meditation Dharma teacher on this reservation. And she was kind of looking at this woman, because this woman wore this hat every day, right? She wore the hat wherever she went. And on this hat, it said, "Fuck you." And so here is this woman who's walking around wondering why people are dissing her. You know, why people are treating her poorly, why they're not welcoming her with open arms. And because she was just blatantly advertising how she felt about all those that approached her. Right? And how often do we do that? How often are we blatantly, the thing we want the most, which is connection and love and to be seen and to feel a part of? I mean, that's why you guys come here, right? There's a whole bunch of you who come here, and I'm assuming you're doing it because you want to be involved in a group of people who are involved in the same thing as you. And we do those kind of things. And then at the same time, we repetitively do these things to shun, to push away. And so one of the things that I'm the most interested in is how we do that. Why do we do that? How do we do that? And oftentimes, it's because we're not paying attention to the fact that there's somebody else there in front of us. We're so busy living in this head of ours, in this self-referencing, self-involved head of ours, that we have a really hard time seeing that somebody else is there. And what the Buddha actually says is that when the hindrances are here, the hindrances being doubt or desire or aversion or sleepiness or restlessness, when any of those are here, we can't see another. We can't see the truth clearly if we're being clouded, if we're busy being somewhere else. If we have an agenda, if we want something from somebody, if we want them to like us, if we want to impress us, if we want to impress them, if we want to get our way, if we don't like what they're saying, if we're judging what they're saying, if we think they're full of shit, if we think they're not as good as us, or maybe they're a child so they just don't know. All these ways that we don't hear people. All these ways that we sort of block out what people are trying to say to us because we're so busy here. And we see it on our cushion, right? We see it when we're in our meditation, just like I was welcoming the stillness. I was welcoming, like, oh, yay, we're all here to meditate. We're all doing this together, knowing that the second we start, what's going to arise? The thoughts, the talking, the judgment, the whatever, the opinions, all the things that come yesterday, tomorrow. So the same thing is happening when we're trying to communicate with another, when we're trying to listen to another, to be there for another. All these things start popping up in our heads. So I just want to ask you guys. I want to ask you, because I've made this really fun list. I think it's fun because I'm kind of nerdy and into this stuff. But I want to ask you guys, what are some of the things that you feel block you or stop you from really being able to hear and listen to another person? Anybody? You guys are all really good listeners. Yes.
You don't trust them.
Don't trust them. Okay, angry or never, right? So we start. So both of those. So that's aversion, right? That there's a way that we push people away. So we kind of just instantly, if they're angry or negative, we don't trust them, that we block them out, right?
Fear.
Seeing ideas and judgments about that person without even knowing them.
Yeah. Constantly, right? She said if we have preconceived ideas and judgments of people without even knowing them. So we're just like, why bother listening to them? I know what's up. Like, I'm hip to everything that's real. So why would I listen to anyone else, right? I got it all figured out. Yeah.
I think about something they say spurs me thinking about something I want to say back to them.
Right.
If I listen to them, I'll forget what I want to say. So I
totally. So there's the 10-second rule for people like you and me. Because we're constantly in this, again, it's that self-referencing, right? Wait, but they're saying that, but I have something better to say. Or I have something different to say. Or I know better, right? So the jumper inners, are you a jumper inner?
Oh,
I'm a jumper inner, right? So it's like, somebody can't, I mean, how many boyfriends I've frustrated and I feel so bad, I'm so sorry, you know, like, you don't listen. I'm not like that anymore, but, you know, that way that we just don't listen, we don't let somebody finish a sentence, right? I mean, it's really kind of, it's painful when we think about it, because how often do you feel unlistened to? And how often do you feel frustrated and unseen and unheard because of that? Thank you. That's a big one. Yeah, so if we have a certain result or outcome, how could anybody else possibly exist? I mean, how many times do we have monologues going on in our heads? I've had so many conversational monologues going on in my head, right? And then when the person's actually there, I'm like, motherfucker, it's not working out the way I planned.
Yeah.
Right? So what do we do? Because it doesn't work that way. That doesn't create unity. It doesn't create connection. It doesn't create connectedness. It's certainly not loving. My mom. I actually really love my mom now. And I didn't used to really love my mom. And one of the reasons I used to didn't really love my mom is because what I said did not matter. Right? How many of you here can relate to that? And it's really hard to say now because I'm a mom, and so I'm anticipating that this story is going to be told about me one day. But does anybody in here watch Mad Men? I'm such a newbie. I just started watching it because I don't have TV. But anyway, in that era, right, the 60s, which is where when I grew up, kids were kind of seen and not heard. It was very much about that. And so that was what it was for me. I was seen and not heard. And not only was I seen and not heard, but if I was heard, it was wrong. So I was very much conditioned to believe that what I had to say didn't matter, that nobody really cared about what I had to say, and that it was just better not to say anything, because why bother? You know? And so I was very much, and even me sitting here right now and talking like I am is really, really hard for me. It's this like sort of neurological patterning that I have to get over. Because I really have this belief, this deep belief system that people don't really care anyway. They don't really care what you have to say. So I even got a little bit lost there because it makes me really sad to think about it. So there's this way that when we think nobody really cares and when nobody's really listening, it's hard to get a full thought across. It's hard to really say what we're feeling. It's hard to even really feel what we're feeling or know what we're feeling. And that's how a lot of us have been conditioned. And then when there's somebody on the other side who really isn't listening, who's jumping in or busy thinking about the outcome, what their outcome is, or thinking you're full of shit, or whatever it is, what we can sense that. We can feel that when the other person is being like that on the other end. And so what that does to me is it just shuts me up. And intimacy is stopped. That person is not going to get to know me because they don't care. Right? So this is what we do over and over and over again. This is a cycle that we create with others, with those around us. And it's a really sad walk. Some of the other things that I had written down about why we don't listen or why it's hard to listen, is sometimes because if we're sitting there listening, you know how you're that person who's the eager listener? Then sometimes the other person can get attracted to you, right? So we're kind of like, I don't want that to happen. So I'm not gonna pretend that I care. She giggles because she gets it. I'm not gonna pretend I care. I'm not gonna really listen. Or we think if we're really listening that we're signing on to what they're saying, that we're actually in agreement with what they're saying. Or if we sit there and really listen, then we can sometimes feel like the victim. If we've ever been a victim before, we can feel like if that person is having rage or anger, that, oh, if I sit here and listen, then I'm taking it. What they're saying must be true about me. After Gore Vidal died, I was listening to a bunch of his interviews and just watching him talk, you know, as we do when people die. And one of the things he said, and it was really interesting, and it made me actually very sad, was he said that the novel was dying, that he was seeing how, you know, the death of the novel. And the reason for that was because we don't really care anymore about another person's life so much. Because reading a novel, we're really diving into somebody else's life or a time or a place, as fictional as it is. We're really deeply interested in finding out about something, absorbing ourselves in something. And he was saying that we don't care anymore. We don't pay attention anymore. And that through deeply listening, it's just allowing ourselves to let somebody else's novel unfold, to let somebody else's story and history unfold. It does not mean anything about us. It doesn't make us less. It doesn't make us invalid. All it does is sort of allow us to hear somebody else's story. And the other thing that deeply listening can do for us is we can learn something that we've never learned before. Something that we never realized or saw before. And one of the things that happened historically during the Buddha's time was, I don't know if you've heard of Ananda, but Ananda was his cousin. But Ananda was also probably his closest attendant. And Ananda had a photographic memory. Ananda could memorize 60,000 words of a discourse at a time without missing one. And a lot of this is attributed to the fact that he had no dust in his eyes, as the Buddha said, like I was saying earlier. When we don't have the hindrances here, we can actually hear to remember. We can hear and take it into our heart. And this is what Ananda did. And this tradition, the Buddhist tradition, was an oral tradition for centuries, for decades and centuries, almost 500 years. It was strictly an oral tradition. And this meant people just telling stories and it being memorized and retold and memorized and retold. But it took a deep caring and a deep ability to listen with a heart that was unblocked and a mind that was clear. So I'm going to actually just read this Hafiz poem. And then I'd love to hear some of your thoughts or questions after that. This poem is called No Expectations. Expectations are premeditated resentment, as we know. A spirit that lives in this world and does not wear the shirt of love, such an existence is a deep disgrace. Be foolishly in love, because love is all there is. There is no way into presence except through a love exchange. If someone asks, but what is love? Answer, dissolving the will, True freedom comes to those who have escaped the questions of free will and fate. Love is an emperor. The two worlds play across him. He barely notices their tumbling game. Love and lover live in eternity. Other desires are substitutes for that way of being. How long do you lay embracing a corpse? Love rather the soul which cannot be held. Anything born in spring dies in the fall, but love is not seasonal. With wine pressed from grapes, expect a hangover. But this love path has no expectations. You are uneasy riding the body? Dismount. Travel lighter. Wings will be given. Be clear like a mirror, reflecting nothing. Be clean of pictures and the worry that comes with images. Gaze into what is not ashamed of truth. Contain all human faces in your own without any judgment of them. Be pure emptiness. What is inside that, you ask? Silence is all I can say. Lovers have some secrets that they keep. You know, sometimes when I have a conversation with somebody, I can't help but see maybe the hundreds or thousands of people standing behind them that have formulated who they are. Their teachers, their parents, their neighborhoods, their cultures, their churches. So anytime I'm talking to one person, there's thousands of influences talking back to me. It's not just that one person. And because of that, there's a lot of compassion. And there's a lot of understanding. And so, like I started to say with my mom, it was just her culture. It was just where she came from. It was all she knew. And now she and I can speak with a lot of love and a lot of understanding for each other. Because there's no expectations.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.